This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick. For those who closely watch the Supreme Court, the phrase first Monday means the High Court is starting its new term. That is, it's the first Monday of October when the justices start hearing new arguments. This term could be a very significant one. The most high-profile case is about a Mississippi abortion law that outlaws that practice after 15 weeks. But there's more to watch, more cases, and the justices themselves who are finding themselves under scrutiny because of the political vibe that has defined so many of their actions lately. CQ Roll Call senior writer and legal affairs correspondent Todd Ruger is here on the podcast to discuss. Todd, welcome to Political Theater.
Thanks, Jason. Great to be here.
I feel like we have a regular vibe going with the Supreme Court. At the end of the last term, it seemed as if there were fewer hot-button issues that the court was considering. It was kind of, you know, I think some of the scholars and journalists referred to it as sort of a transitional term, if you will, with the latest lineup of six Republican-appointed justices and three Democratic-appointed justices. And this next term promises to be a little different because, abortion, which has been a sort of defined so much of politics the last 50 years. This case in Mississippi that's coming before them that they'll hear in December is going to be, you know, possibly the most direct challenge that we've seen in a while to Roe versus Wade, but there are other things. So, but let's, before we start getting into the caseloads themselves, because, and they are significant, I want to talk about them. Let's talk about where the justices are, congressional recess, you know, the justices seem to fan out and defend themselves in ways that we, justices talk all the time at, you know, different forums and colleges and so forth. But there was almost a defensive posture that Clarence Thomas, Amy Coney Barrett, Stephen Breyer all found themselves in. Why all of a sudden are we seeing justices sort of defend themselves, their conduct in the court so vigorously?
Well, I think you have a situation where the confirmation process in the Senate was so heated and that the Republicans used the Senate rules to their ultimate end and blocked one of Obama's nominees, put one of Trump's nominees on the court just before the election, seemingly to contradict themselves as to when a Supreme Court justice should be confirmed in relation to a presidential election. And so you have a superheated situation because that ultimately moved the court from 5-4 to 6-3. And you mentioned that it was a transitional term. And that's because it was the first, this last term that ended in back July 1st, basically. That was the first time that it had been 6-3. And it was during the middle of the pandemic. They never even met in person. But by the end of the term, they had set up what we have coming now in October, which is a new term that has some of the biggest issues on it. In the meantime, on the last day of the term, they put down two decisions on common ideological grounds, 6-3, Republican appointees versus Democratic appointees, on voting rights and money in politics, which are two big hot-button issues. And then over the summer, you had this emergency docket, these emergency requests, and there was a series of decisions that they made on that, some about the COVID restrictions in New York and California, where the Supreme Court got involved and struck them down on religious liberty grounds. And then you had this Texas abortion law get up there, and the justices let it go into effect, even though the law, once it's in effect, is basically contrary to the last 50 years of Supreme Court precedent, starting in 1973 with Roe v. Wade. So you have intense scrutiny on everything that they're doing because they're touching some of the biggest topics that are out there. Some of the justices have gone out and done sort of what you could call a public relations tour for the court, saying we're not political, we're making judicial philosophy decisions, not political decisions. That they usually don't defend the reputation of the court that upfront, and there's usually not that many in a row. So it's sort of notable that they're going out there and doing this.
I would note, too, that, I mean, I mentioned that the three sort of most prominent ones were Clarence Thomas, who's the longest-serving justice at this point. He sort of said, that, you know, we're not ideological. We're just judicial scholars, if you will. I'm saying it sort of inarticulately, but he defended that it's not a political organization. But then most interesting for me, too, was that Stephen Breyer, you know, sort of went on a little bit of a publicity tour for a book that he wrote. Now, he was appointed by President Clinton in the 90s, and he is not a young man, we can say diplomatically. Liberals and Democrats have been pressuring him, you know, some sort of more diplomatically than not, to retire so that President Biden can pick somebody, and it can be, and that pick could be confirmed by a Democratic Senate. He defended, you know, the court as non-political and also his place in it. And then Amy Coney Barrett appeared at the McConnell Center in Kentucky, named after Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who was so instrumental in getting her confirmed right before the 2020 election. So it's interesting that they're defending themselves in, whether they like it or not, these are overt political times.
Right. I think that part of the Supreme Court's defensive posture right now is everything that's happening around it. You know, they didn't elect Donald Trump to be president. They didn't elect Mitch McConnell to be the Senate Majority Leader, who shepherded through three of Donald Trump's picks and shifted the court. But, you know, in the past, they've had the conservatives have had a 5-4 advantage for decades, right? But they have always had somebody in the middle that was sort of, we're not going to go quite there yet. I mean, on the issue of abortion, there hasn't been a major swing in that for years. The Second Amendment and gun rights, which is another case coming up, they haven't touched that since the original decision in a case called Heller that said you have a constitutional right to defend yourself in your home. In the meantime, there have all been all these states that have put out all these laws that the Supreme Court has not reviewed, you know, limiting the size of magazines, limiting what type of guns you can have. Supreme Court hasn't touched it. Now, all of a sudden, they've taken a case because it's 6-3 and there's less of a regulator on that push to the right. And most people who are observers of the Supreme Court think now this is the moment when they could go to the right. That limiter is gone, and the two issues that they have teed up, abortion, guns, huge. So this is a political atmosphere. The issues they're touching are incredibly political. They run through, you know, every congressional campaign, every primary, every Republican primary, every presidential race.
So let's talk about the caseload for the new term, I don't want to lose track also of the docket, the emergency docket, because I know that you actually tuned into a hearing in the Senate today about this docket, and it's under a little bit of discussion, more than you normally get, some more chatter than you normally get.
Yeah, absolutely. to your point earlier, Justice Alito is going to be giving a speech on this emergency docket, you know, presumably defending it. And so he's going out and making a public case because it's just this thing that usually isn't in the public eye is now incredibly in the public eye because, as some abortion advocates have said, letting this Texas law go into effect took away the constitutional right to abortion for 1 out of 10 women in America who are of reproductive age because Texas is such a huge state.
We'll return to the docket, the emergency docket, after we go run through kind of the biggest cases that you'll be tuning into that, and probably will have, you know, arguably the farthest reach. There is a law that the Mississippi legislature passed and the governor signed down there is under consideration. The Supreme Court will hear this in December, and this would outlaw the practice after 15 weeks. And this is very much a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade, right? I mean, like the Texas law, is a this weird situation where private citizens are kind of deputized to like sue people over abortion, which is odd and a way that they sort of evaded some judicial review, at least at this point. But the Mississippi law, this is very much a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. Like that, it was almost like waiting for Barrett's vote.
Right. So Republican-led states have been passing laws that go against Roe v. Wade and Casey v. Planned Parenthood, which is a 1992 decision that's really important. That set up basically a viability standard as to when states might be able to ban abortion. If the fetus can survive outside of the womb on its own, then you can ban it after that. Well, a 15-week ban is considered before that under current, basically what everybody has agreed to. That's earlier than that. And the Texas one is a 6-week ban, so that's even earlier. There's nobody that has argued, that basically argues that under the current Supreme Court precedents, Mississippi's 15-week ban after 15 weeks is would withhold scrutiny. And yet the justices have agreed to hear it. So there's a saying that, the justices don't take a case just to tell the lower court they got it right. There's usually something that they think that
there's
they need
no
to say.
There's no attaboy cases?
not very many. And so in this case, what you're doing is you're opening up the Roe v. Wade and Casey Planned Parenthood box. And once they open it, you're not sure what they're going to do. And the Mississippi in this case has asked them to overturn these precedents. A bunch of the friends of the court briefs, including Republican lawmakers, have asked them to do the same. What we don't know is what the justices are going to do ultimately, if they're going to find some sort of narrow ground. Are they going to say, well, we actually took this case in error, but we're going to kick it back, or the lower court to consider something else? There's always some off ramps that might take, or are they going to go all the way? Do they have the votes for that? And so you've got, I guess that's what everybody's watching. But there's really, I think, little indication that they would actually just uphold the current law as it is.
And the gun rights case, this has gotten a little less attention than the abortion case. And again, we should say that the abortion case will be heard in December. The decision won't come out until like the late summer, right before the court wraps up the term, which is usually late June, early July. So, I mean, that will just happen to place it right in the middle of the midterm election season with unknown consequences about who that would motivate, depending on what the result is. But this gun rights case, though, has gotten a lot less attention. Let's talk about that one.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court took a Second Amendment case for the first time in a long time. I believe it was last term. And they said, and it ended up, New York got rid of the law. And so the Supreme Court ended up saying, oh, well, this case is moot then. But the Republican appointed justices have been itching for another case on the Second Amendment. Here it comes. And this one is on concealed carry permits, which is a thing that a lot of states have put into place, and there's a lot of discrepancy between the states on who can carry a weapon and concealed and who can get a permit for it. And New York City has one of the strictest laws about who they give it to. It's not enough just to say, like, I kind of want to defend myself. You have to have a particularized reason. And for that reason, they're saying it's essentially stopping their Second Amendment right, these two gun owners and a gun group is basically saying it's stopping the Second Amendment right to possess firearms. Now, that goes beyond the home. The original Supreme Court ruling that said that there was a right to bear arms said it was for defense in the home. So now that this is, they could consider, does this mean for defense outside of the home? And again, you have, once you open up that Second Amendment box, what are these nine justices going to come up with to say what the contours of the Second Amendment are and how much states can ban firearms and the carrying of firearms in public?
And you mentioned Heller, this case from 2008. It was District of Columbia versus Heller. Heller had challenged the District of Columbia's handgun ban. You know, he had gotten a couple of courts to rule, the courts had ruled sort of for him, and the District of Columbia, like, challenged, they challenged it to the Supreme Court. They wanted the Supreme Court to uphold, like, their gun ban, and it did not work out to the District of Columbia's favor. I remember some of the debate about, like, how they should do this, because it would affect more than just simply the District of Columbia if they went to the Supreme Court. And this was the last time that we had one of these major rulings where the justices said very affirmatively there is a right for people to possess handguns in their own home, which, you know, some people had pushed, saying that the Second Amendment, you know, talks about militias and all this kind of stuff. So this, as you said, they haven't had a lot of chances to rule past that, this New York law, you know, that was moot, that you referred to in the last term. And so all of a sudden we find ourselves in this situation where guns and abortion, two of the biggest, you know, topics that define people's, you know, sort of passions in politics, are going to be before this court. So is it really any wonder that justices find themselves, you know, like, thought of as political animals if this is what they're ruling on and they have the potential to affect, you know, the lives of millions of people?
Right. I don't think they should be surprised at all. But, you know, it's one of those things that that the politics isn't necessarily solving. So once again, it's kicked to the courts to solve, or states to try to figure out. And you know, when you look at how each side wants the court to rule, you know, they want to say, well, on the Second Amendment, stay out of states' ability to regulate. And on the abortion, the other side, they say states should be able to regulate abortion however they want. And so, you know, there's a thread through all of these that are going to constantly be pulled up in campaigning throughout the next year. I've seen fundraising emails off of the abortion decision already. I've seen, I've seen fundraising.
You've seen things, Todd.
Well, it's just, I mean, I've heard things, I've seen things. No, it's out there, and it's not going to stop, because the Texas case, it's not before the court right now. There's an application by some groups to reconsider their decision. The Justice Department has filed a challenge to the Texas law that probably will come up in the next month or two or three. So they're going to have to deal with that. So it's going to, not only is there going to be the oral argument, but then on the Mississippi case, but then these minor decisions on the Texas case, and then the final decision on the Mississippi case in June. It's not going to go away, and it's going to be a major, major, major issue.
Is there something more than major, or do you just have to keep saying major? I mean, is it major? Like, there was a character in Catch-22, major, 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 major.
It's more major than that.
More major than that.
I mean,
it's five majors.
You know this. It's run through. It's run through all sorts of politics. It's been a major pillar of the Republican platform forever, and you kind of wonder, like, if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, what happens to that issue? And you know, what's interesting is watching what's happening in Texas right now, because, you know, the Justice Department filed this brief that said, here's all of these petitions, here's all this documentation we have for women not being able to get an abortion in Texas, them having to travel hundreds of miles to neighboring states having overflowing abortion clinics with Texas residents, and many Texas residents not able to afford either the time or the money to travel across state lines to get an abortion. So pretty soon we're going to start seeing the fallout of what might happen if they strike down Roe v. Wade. Happening in real time, and how is that going to play in with their decision? And when they, you know, they're going to hear the case, but they're probably not going to decide it for months. So, like, are they going to be watching what's happening in Texas the whole time? It's going to be a rapidly developing area for something that's been pretty stable for quite a long time.
Right, and to your point about, you know, Congress has not addressed this. I mean, the House passed the Democratic-controlled House passed a bill recently that affirmed Roe versus Wade as the law of the land and a right to an abortion. They kicked it to the Senate, where it is expected to be promptly filibustered as soon as it comes up on the floor. The vast majority of the Republican Party, is anti-abortion. Certainly, the vast majority of Republican senators are, so they have the votes to block it. So it ends up back again in the Supreme Court's lap to address this thing that Congress cannot. And it seems like that's, going to be the kind of the dynamic for a while. The discussion back to Texas, I think, gives us an opportunity to go back to this, what's going on with this emergency docket. So this docket, explain what this is. Some people call it the emergency docket. That's what the justices prefer to call it. Some people call it the shadow docket, which sounds kind of, a villainous sort of thing. I'm sure there are other terms that are used for it. But what is it? Just tell our listeners, what is this docket, this mysterious docket or emergency docket, depending on your viewpoint?
Yeah. So every court that exists in America pretty much has to deal with emergency motions and emergency actions, and they have to deal with them immediately, because there are emergencies. And here in particular, in the Texas case, as an example, the women in Texas and those that are challenging it, the law said, our constitutional rights are going to be infringed on this particular day when it goes into effect, unless you stop it from going into effect. So the court only has until that certain day. So there's no way that they're going to, have a full briefing. Oral arguments, months to ponder and write and discuss and then come out with a reasoned opinion. They just have to do something right away. They often have done something, this usually comes up in like capital cases where there's somebody that's on death row in a state and they have a last minute appeal and they're going to be executed at midnight unless the Supreme Court does something. So that, they do it often, and a lot of times it's life or death. Now, in this particular case, and this summer, the COVID protocol issue that they ruled about religious liberty, they ruled in that way, but they didn't have a briefing. They didn't have a full oral arguments and on that right.
But they do still vote.
They do vote. Yeah, they do vote. And it takes five votes to do something. And then on the Texas abortion one, it was 6-3, or it was 5-4, excuse me, the Chief Justice joined the three liberals to say, we should try to put a stop to this. And they could have said, they have five votes, they could pretty much do anything, right? They could say, well, you know what, let's just put it on hold for 2 weeks and we'll do something really fast, or let's put it on hold for a month and we'll do something a little slower. And yet, in the end, they were basically like, we don't have the ability to do anything because there's no defendant in this case. And there's no defendant in this case because of the way that the law was set up in this crazy way that it's civilians that would enforce it rather than the state. State officials usually would enforce something like that. And so they didn't do that. And what the dissenters in that case, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, most notably, were basically like, we keep using this shadow docket more and more to issue more substantive stuff, and that doesn't have a full reasoning. There's, if they want to dissent, they can, but there's no requirement that they dissent or say how they voted. Sometimes it's just the court says, and so you've got, in this particular case, I think why it's gotten so much attention now is because you've got this thing that abortion, which has driven so much of politics for 50 years, and then to allow a law to go in to infringe that without a full hearing. I mean, it's like, it's just the biggest deal that the Supreme Court issued, this biggest issue the Supreme Court could deal with. And they did it in this way. Yeah, five majors.
Five majors. Yeah, and again, not to make light of it, but it seems that the justices sort of crying like, don't judge us as political figures, does seem to ring hollow when they are basically, they have political like decisions or political ramifications to everything they're doing. So it does seem that, I mean, if they're going to continue to use this as Kagan and Sotomayor warned, it just opens them up to even more, because, you know, it's been abortion and a couple of other issues, but what if it's something that is beyond just like a capital case or something like that? And, you know, it's going to be every institution changes, but this does seem to be picking up a lot of steam lately.
Yeah, and so much attention. And as one law professor said recently, this is basically if the justices keep coming out with decisions that they say is judicially motivated, judicial philosophy motivated, but they just always happen to align with the political brand of the president who appointed them. The public's not going to buy that for very long. And so they've got a really intricate, complex problem on their hand that they're dealing with this term.
And another thing that people will be discussing too as the term progresses is, you know, Stephen Breyer is sticking around for another term. I mean, he'll be there at least for this term, it seems, or intends to be. And, you know, if... depending on what happens in the next midterm election, that could be really something. You know, the focus will be on him a lot, because as somebody who's in a dwindling minority of Democratic appointees, he'll be under a lot of pressure to retire. So in our last podcast with you, you said, like, this is all about Breyer Watch. Breyer decided to just go on a book tour and talk about how great life on the Supreme Court is, even into your 80s. And, you know, there he is. So it's just going to continue to be a political sort of situation. One thing that's doesn't seem to be political that we can talk about just on a logistics level is that for the first time since the pandemic started, they will have live arguments and attendance at the court. So that's a little bit of a change, a little bit of a turning point.
Yeah, it's wild. I talked to a reporter today who went back to the courthouse this time, you know, for the first time in 18 months to make sure that his computer still worked when he was there, you know, because it's just been forever. And they are extremely limiting the number of people that are in there, essential court personnel, the justices, the arguing attorneys, and a few members of the media. No public, though, still closed to the public. And as a result, they are still going to be live streaming these arguments, which... I'm all in favor of. That's been a great aside to the COVID. The unfortunate COVID has this aside where there's been a lot more access to listening to the oral arguments, and you know, I don't. They are going to change the format a bit. When they were doing this live streaming stuff and they were doing it by teleconference, they took turns asking questions. They're still going to have something like that now in oral arguments, which they never had before. It's usually just a free for all. But now that it's basically they're going to stop at a certain point and say, okay, do you have any questions? Do you have any questions? Do you have any questions? And so it'll be a different dynamic. And then we don't know what's going to happen if the pandemic goes away, and they have this plan through December. So in January, are they going to continue to stream them or not? We don't know. So, but yeah, they're returning to in-person work.
Well, first Monday, it's not just a... Walter Matthau movie from long ago about the Supreme Court. we'll expect your film review of that classic of American cinema at some point.
I'll have to go rewatch it.
But yes, first Monday, that is the first day of the Supreme Court's new term. I know it's been this will be another really interesting round to cover. So thanks for doing that for us.
Yep, you got it.
All right, thanks, Todd.